Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now going to cover Psalms chapter 97. I will entitle the psalm, The Lord Reigns. This psalm does not have a heading, so we'll jump right into the exposition of the psalm. We don't know who the psalmist is because there is no heading, so I will just call him the psalmist. The psalmist begins in verse 1. The Lord reigns. Let the earth rejoice. Let the many coasts and islands be glad. Clouds and thick darkness surround him. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. Fire goes before him and burns up his foes on every side. His lightning lights up the world. The earth sees and trembles. The mountains melt like wax at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the Lord of all the earth. The heavens proclaim his righteousness. All the people see his glory. So we see this psalm is a psalm of praise of the greatness and majesty of the Lord. In verse 1, the psalmist says, let the earth rejoice. Earth, of course, can always be translated as land, but I don't think it's land here because the last part of the verse 1, using Hebrew parallelism, the last part of verse 1 says, let many coasts and islands be glad. That would refer to all the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, I presume, or maybe the Red Sea, the islands of the Mediterranean Sea. But there's lots of coasts and islands in the world, but not in the land of Israel. So this is the whole earth is going to rejoice because the Lord reigns. Now, of course, that does not include the people on the earth who don't like the Lord, who hate the Lord, and who ignore the Lord. But for those over whom the Lord reigns, all over the earth, the whole world, we will rejoice. Verse 2, clouds and thick darkness surround him. Now, that probably refers to storm clouds that emphasize God's awesome power, like what happened at the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. Remember, clouds and thick darkness surrounded the mountain as the law was given. John Gill suggests it could refer to the Shekinah glory in the tabernacle or the temple, but I don't think clouds and thick darkness refers to the Shekinah glory. Clouds and thick darkness sound like judgment. The Shekinah glory was more like presence, so I don't think that suggestion by Gill. He might not actually believe that. He just mentions it. So I don't think that's it. Adam Clark suggests that clouds and thick darkness are an abstract symbol for the quote-unquote impenetrable obscurity of God. Well, it could be the hidden God up there in the clouds, but I think it's more like the idea of judgment because in the last part of verse 2, we see righteousness and justice. That is not talking about God's hiddenness. It's talking about his justice. And that means judgment, and clouds and thick darkness are a perfect symbol of judgment. If you've ever lived through a severe thunderstorm, as I'm sure you have, it sounds like judgment. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of God's throne. The throne is a symbol standing for God's rule. His rule in the universe is based totally on righteousness and justice, and any governmental leader who is trying to imitate God will make the throne of his kingdom based upon righteousness and justice as much as he can in this fallen, sinful world. Verse 3, fire goes before God and burns up his foes on every side. So we see the clouds and thick darkness accompanied with fire. Fire sometimes can be translated as lightning. Lightning burns up his foes on every side. In fact, in verse 4, it says his lightning lights up the world after it has burned up God's foes on every side. Verse 4, God's lightning lights up the world. The earth sees and trembles. The reason the earth sees is because there's lightning everywhere in the midst of the storm. This is great imagery because if you've been in a lightning storm, you know that these flashes just light up everything in the midst of the darkness, and it scares you to death. Verse 5, the mountains melt like wax at the presence of the Lord. Now you ask me, how can a mountain melt? Well, this is poetic imagery. It is what some have called decreation rhetoric. It symbolizes judgment. Now, in the Old Testament, when you see regime change about to take place, as God judges one regime, one empire, and it is about to be taken over by another empire, for example, in Isaiah chapter 13, when Babylon goes down, you see all this decreation rhetoric. The stars fall from the sky like figs falling off a tree. The moon turns to blood. The sun becomes dark. The skies are rolled up like a garment. You're familiar with that. And of course, you typically think, oh, that's the end of the world. No, it's the end of a regime. It's not the end of the world. The eschatology nuts, the Tim LaHayes, and the Hal Lindseys of this world have conditioned the modern Christian's mind to think that this is referring to the end of the world. No, it's referring to God's judgment on an empire, and it's easily provable if people would take the time to look in the Old Testament, which they don't because they're too busy reading the aforesaid Tim LaHaye and Hal Lindsey books. So the mountains melt like wax at the presence of the Lord, again, perfect symbol of judgment at the presence of the Lord of all the earth. And of course, that earth there is not the land, it's the whole earth here. I mentioned that there were many examples, many instances of decreation rhetoric in the Old Testament. I won't spend time reading them all to you, but I'll give you an example. Habakkuk 3, verse 6. He, that's God, stood and surveyed the earth. He looked and startled the nations. Yes, the perpetual mountains were shattered. The ancient hills collapsed. That's the same thing as saying the mountains melted. Now, in verse 6, the psalmist says, the heavens proclaim his righteousness. All the people see his glory. How do the heavens proclaim God's righteousness? Couple of options from John Gale. Option number one, the heavens proclaim God's righteousness because the wrath of God comes from heaven. Romans 1:18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So God sends wrath to evil people, and God lives in heaven, so the wrath is said to be revealed from heaven because that's where the wrath comes from, where God lives. But I don't think that's what the psalmist meant here, although it sounds good, but I don't think so. I think what the psalmist is referring to, if you go by the context here, he's referring to the heavens from which the thunder and lightning come that he's talked about. The thunder and lightning proclaim his righteousness. All the people see his glory when people look at an awesome thunderstorm. Well, what glory do the people see? Option one, the glory of God's justice in the destruction of his enemies. Option number two, the glory in bringing the elect to himself. Or it could be both A and B, because when you have judgment, you have salvation. When you have salvation, you have judgment. There are two sides to the same coin. You cannot have one without the other, given the ugly realities of this present sinful world. We go now to Psalms 97, 7 through 12, and we will finish the discussion of this psalm. The psalmist continues, all who serve carved images, those who boast in idols, will be put to shame. All the gods must worship him. Zion hears and is glad, and the towns of Judah rejoice because of your judgments, Lord. For you, Lord, are the Most High over all the earth. You are exalted above all the gods. You who love the Lord hate evil. He protects the lives of his godly ones. He rescues them from the power of the wicked. Light dawns for the righteous, gladness for the upright in heart. Be glad in Yahweh, you righteous ones, and praise his holy name. Now the first six verses of Psalms 97 talk about God's judgment. That theme will continue in the last six verses of the psalm, but also we will see rejoicing on the part of the righteous occur simultaneously with the judgment. Verse 7, all who serve carved images, those who boast in idols, will be put to shame. All the gods must worship him. Well, that word gods, I think it's Elohim in the Hebrew, it can mean one of three things. It can mean idols, all the idols must worship God. It could refer to magistrates or political civic leaders must worship God, or it could refer to angels who must worship God. So which is it? Well, the context favors idols because verse 7 mentions those who boast in idols will be put to shame. All the gods must worship him. And if you use the Hebrew parallelism technique, well, then idols is in parallel with gods. And so that's probably what it is. Gods, of course, can also mean civil magistrates. You are gods. And that's true. The civil magistrates must worship him, but there's nothing in the context to suggest that that's what the psalmist meant. Now, the Septuagint translation of this verse translates gods here as angels. Hoi angeloi autou, his angels. This is Adam Clark. So the Septuagint and the apostle, let all the angels of God worship him, referring to the passage in Hebrews 1:6. Let me read that. And when he, God, again brings the firstborn into the world, that's Jesus, he says, and let all the angels of God worship him. That's a quote directly from our psalm here, Psalm 97, verse 7, according to the NASB note. And so the Septuagint takes gods here and translates it into the Greek from the Hebrew as angels, not gods. Well, lest we think that that's what the psalmist meant, we need to point out that just because the New Testament author used the Septuagint and said that all the angels of God are worshiping Jesus, that doesn't mean that's what the psalmist meant. He could have meant idols. And I think that's what he did mean. All the idols must worship him. But it doesn't really matter because idols, civil magistrates or angels are all going to worship God. Everybody's going to worship God sooner or later. Verse 8, Zion hears and is glad. Zion, of course, is the standard Old Testament symbol. The physical Zion is the city of David in Jerusalem, sometimes extended to the city of David plus Mount Moriah at the northwestern end of the city of David. Sometimes it refers to the whole city of Jerusalem. Sometimes it refers to the whole nation. And here, I believe, it refers to the whole nation of Israel because of Hebrew parallelism here. The first part of verse 8 says Zion. The second part of verse 8 says the towns of Judah rejoice. So Zion refers to all of Judah. And of course, spiritually, Zion is where God dwells with his people. It's used as a symbol for that many, many times, Old Testament and New Testament. Zion hears and is glad, and the towns of Judah rejoice. Now, that is the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. Many translations, or at least some translations, translate it literally as daughters of Zion, and that's always confusing. A daughter in the Hebrew parlance means the population of a town, or the daughters of Zion would mean the towns of Zion. The daughters of Jerusalem are the people of Jerusalem. So translating the metaphor a little more tightly, we end up with the towns of Jerusalem. The NASB translates it as daughters of Judah. Zion heard this and was glad, and the daughters of Judah have rejoiced. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, the towns of Judah. If you take it literally, Zion is the mother, and all the villages in the country are her daughters. Now in verse 8, we see everybody in Israel, everybody in Judah. Judah is short for Israel, even though technically it's only the southern two tribes. Everybody in Israel rejoices because of your judgments. Rejoicing because of judgments. Usually you think of judgments coming from God as something bad, like the thunderstorms mentioned in the first six verses of this psalm. That's for the bad guys. But for the people who love God and who are righteous and upright, a judgment of God is a good thing because evil are destroyed, because evil people love to whip up on righteous people. Now, if you think for a minute, if you live in present-day America, that the LGBTQ, LSMFT, plus Q, whatever, if you think these gender-bending American citizens are going to treat Christians fairly and equitably, just look at the history of what they've done so far. They're not content to live their lives of perversion by themselves. They are intent on attacking Christians at every chance they get, and they will do that until they are destroyed by God's judgment, and then the righteous people can rejoice. The Christian can say, well, you know, you asked for it. Now, I don't want to sound harsh. Of course, we should pray for those homosexuals and transgender people who have perverted their sexuality in order to conform themselves to the culture or to their lust. A lot of Christians have come out of that community, and I hope a lot more do. But those that don't, they're going to persecute those that do, or that those who never have entered into that, they're going to persecute them, and they are eventually going to be judged for it. And this is exactly what the psalmist is saying here. The righteous people need to rejoice because of God's judgment. Now, that's something we don't often hear in the present-day wussy-pussy evangelical church, but it's in the scriptures here. Let me read it again for you. The towns of Judah rejoice because of your judgments. Verse 9, for you, Lord, are the Most High over all the earth. You are exalted. Exalted is in parallel with Most High. That's what exalted means. Most High. That which there is none more high. That's bad grammar. That which above whom there is no one higher. You are exalted above all the gods. Verse 10, you who love the Lord hate evil. He, God, protects the lives of his godly ones. Now here we have a little problem because it's difficult to balance this phrase here with the examples of suffering and persecution we see in the scriptures. For example, in Hebrews, there was someone who was sawn in two, if you recall. They were obviously not protected. How about the Apostle Paul? He was protected many times until he was captured and imprisoned at the end of his life. Peter was saved from arrest in Jerusalem in the beginning of his ministry, but he was executed at the end of it, if tradition is accurate. Well, what's the solution to this little problem? This is my solution. God does indeed preserve and deliver his children many times, in fact, but the verse doesn't say every time God delivers. There are times when we are tested and tried. Sometimes it is just our time to go be with Jesus. How about Jesus' example? He was protected many times during his ministry, but he was finally crucified. But of course, he went to sit at the right hand of God the Father, so he ended up in good shape. Same with us. If we don't make it on this earth, we're going to make it in the next. And while we're on this earth, we will be rescued many, many times. But maybe when it's time for you to go, you won't be rescued. I don't think that's a difficult problem of harmony. Protection from the attacks of the wicked does not mean exemption from the attacks of the wicked, by the way. We will always suffer such attacks. There can be no deliverance unless there's oppression. There can be no healing unless there's sickness. There can be no victory unless there is warfare. So a lot of good things we experience is because of the bad things that are done to us. Verse 11, the psalmist says, "Light dawns for the righteous. Gladness for the upright in heart." Light is in parallel with gladness. Typically, light makes one feel cheery, you know, the bright, sunny room as opposed to the dark, gloomy room. David in Psalms 27:1 says this, "The Lord is my light and my salvation." So light is associated with salvation. And again, that salvation is probably temporal salvation. It could be eternal, probably temporal. But at any rate, the light is dawning for the righteous. And once again, the psalmist ends up on a positive note. Light is dawning, gladness is coming. Be glad in Yahweh, you righteous ones, and praise his holy name. So on that uplifting note, we are now finished with Psalms 97, and we are now prepared to go to Psalms 98, which I will entitle, "Make a Joyful Noise to the Lord." I hope you join with me in the exposition of our next psalm, and I hope you have enjoyed this one.